If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, Seth talks to filmmaker Martin McDonagh, who sticks around at Studio 8G to take a few more questions exclusively for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
On his 12-day trip to Asia, President Trump has spent time cozying up to authoritarian strongmen while he increasingly acts like one himself. Meanwhile, there's yet more new information about the Trump campaign's relationship with WikiLeaks. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Trump's trip to Asia has been mostly unremarkable, except for that time he taunted a nuclear-armed nation on Twitter and broed out with Vladimir Putin. I think they took a pottery class together. I don't know. It's hard to remember. That was like 9 news stories ago. But of course, in Trump's mind, everything he does is unprecedented. In fact, while talking to reporters on Air Force One, Trump even alluded to a mysterious bet about how long a human being could last on a trip like this. Trump said, "I think it's been a great trip. In certain ways, it's been very epic. And by the way, anybody that took the bet, pick up your money, okay?" Reporter, "What was the bet again?" Trump, "Well, a lot of people said it's almost physically impossible for someone to go through 12 days. What? 12 days? Nobody tell Trump about Keith Richards. That guy's been on tour for 50 years, and he still looks better than you did before you left. Trump flew to Asia. Trump flew to Asia on the most comfortable jet in the world, and he talks about it like he was a contestant on Naked and Afraid. "Nobody thought I would make it, but I managed to fashion a fishing pole out of a golf club in one of Melania's earrings." Well, Trump is focused on bragging about his endurance. Back here at home, his inner circle is dealing with yet more information about his potential involvement in Russian election meddling. And you'll never guess which Trump family member is once again mixed up in all of it. I'll give you a hint. He has the same name as a famous idiot.
Breaking news tonight, another incredible report about Trump campaign communications. And once again, Donald Trump Jr. is at the center of it all.
Breaking news tonight in the Russia investigation. A new report details secret communications between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks, the group that published the hacked Clinton camp emails allegedly stolen by Russia.
Of course it was Don Jr. He's the dumbest member of a family in which there is stiff competition. That family still hasn't finished a game of Trivial Pursuit they started in 1988. "What category do you want, Dad? Give me New York City buildings between 53rd and 59th. Also, it's not often we can say this, so let's do it while we can. Today is a good day to be Eric. Give it up for Eric, everybody.
I didn't collude, Father.
Although Eric probably couldn't collude if he tried. If Julian Assange had reached out to Eric instead of Don Jr. on Twitter, it would look like this. "Eric, Julian Assange here. We have some interesting information on the Clinton campaign. My name is also Eric." "Yes, I know. My name is Julian Assange." "Hi, Julian. I'm Eric." "Hi, Eric. We have some interesting information on the Clinton campaign." "Who does?" "Me, Julian Assange." "Oh, I just met him." Now, this news adds more context to what we already know about the Trump campaign's interest in obtaining Hillary's emails, and its relationship with WikiLeaks. Of course, we already know Don Jr. and several other Trump campaign aides, including one who has since been indicted, actively sought dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russians. And now we know that on admittedly a limited basis, Don Jr. did communicate with WikiLeaks. Take this exchange, for example. After Trump advisor Roger Stone foreshadowed the hacked emails by tweeting Wednesday, Hillary Clinton is done, hashtag WikiLeaks, Don Jr. then actively sought out WikiLeaks to find out what they had planned, writing, "What's behind this Wednesday leak I kept reading about?" Amazing. He literally inquired in writing about a potential crime. Don Jr. is the kind of guy who, if he ever robbed a bank, would post a selfie from inside the vault. Of course, before this, the Trump campaign maintained publicly at the time that they had nothing to do with WikiLeaks, which we now know is false. For example, Vice President Mike Pence dismissed the idea that the Trump campaign had any contact with WikiLeaks when he was asked about it in October.
Final question about WikiLeaks, and that is, some have suggested on the left that all this bad stuff about Hillary, nothing bad about Trump, that your campaign is in cahoots with WikiLeaks.
Nothing could be further from the truth.
In fairness to Mike Pence, he probably thinks cahoots is a dirty word. I never eat alone with a woman other than my wife so as to avoid staring at her cahoots. I'm very serious. Of course, while the very real and very productive investigation into Trump's ties to Russia escalates, Trump has remained obsessed with the candidate who did not become president, Hillary Clinton. He's repeatedly demanded that the Justice Department investigate a series of fake Clinton scandals manufactured by the right. It even complained in an interview that he couldn't be more directly involved with the Justice Department.
Are you aware of any investigations by Department of Justice of any of the Clinton
You know,
entities?
I'd love to be much more involved, but I'm not supposed to be involved with Department of Justice, so I have to hope that they run themselves well. But as you know, as president, you're not supposed to be involved with the Department of Justice. A lot of people ask me that question. I give them that answer, and they say, "Ah, now I understand."
No one has ever said, "Oh, now I understand," in response to Donald Trump. Or if they did, they probably didn't mean it the way he took it. "Did you know Puerto Rico is an island surrounded by water? Oh, now I understand. You have a head injury." Of course. Contrary to Trump's claim that he's not involved with the Justice Department, he has repeatedly demanded that his Attorney General Jeff Sessions investigate Clinton in tweets and interviews, and, of course, berated Sessions in the Oval Office, threatening his job. And now it seems like Sessions may have got the message. Because yesterday, the New York Times reported that prosecutors were looking into whether a special counsel should be appointed to investigate political rivals President Trump has singled out for scrutiny, including Hillary Clinton. Today, Sessions testified before the White House Judiciary Committee and was asked point blank about the government using the justice system to investigate political opponents. It should be easy to get a straight answer to that question, and yet, both Sessions and Congressman John Conyers seem to keep going in circles.
Yes or no, please. In a functioning democracy, is it common for the leader of the country to order the criminal justice system to retaliate against his political opponents?
Is that a question?
Yes, that's the question.
Mr. Conyers, I would say that it's... The Department of Justice can never be used to retaliate politically against opponents, and that would be wrong.
I interpret that as no.
The answer stands for itself, I guess.
Oh, my God. Are they in the same room? Because it seems like there's a satellite delay. I'm sorry, Mr. Conyers, but I think a storm is messing with our connection. Fortunately, it's not surprising Trump would behave more and more like a dictator, given his obvious affinity for dictators and strongmen, an affinity we've seen on display during his trip to Asia. In fact, a reporter asked Trump about his friendship with dictators, and watching this transcript as he jumps the gun before the reporter is finished asking the question, thinking it's an opportunity to brag about how popular he is with world leaders. Reporter, you seem to have a fairly warm relationship with a number of "I do" totalitarian or authoritarian leaders and others who can't help themselves. He has to jump the gun. I'd love to see him be interrogated for murder. You seem to have an impressive amount of "I do" blood on your shoes. And other places. Now, Trump, of course, does have a warm relationship with Putin, but he also seems to be striking up a budding friendship with another authoritarian strongman, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. Duterte has waged a brutal drug war that has killed tens of thousands of people, but that hasn't come between Duterte and Trump. In fact, the budding romance between these two wannabe strongmen is apparently so intense that Duterte actually serenaded Trump during dinner.
President Duterte taking to the stage to sing a Filipino love song. He said it was at the request of President Trump.
Now that is a human rights violation. I never thought I'd say this, but Rodrigo Duterte, you are not going to Hollywood. Trump, of course, has been cozying up to Duterte since his first days in office, fawning over him in a leaked transcript of a telephone call and complimenting his brutal war on drugs. Here are some highlights from that call. Trump, I just wanted to congratulate you because I'm hearing of the unbelievable job on the drug problem. We had a previous president who did not understand that, but I understand that, and we have spoken about this before. Duterte, yes, I know that. Thank you. Yes. Trump, so how is everyone doing? How is the Philippines doing? Why is he talking like everyone in the Philippines is gathered around the phone? Does he know the Philippines is a country and not a family? Honey, I think we should have the Philippines over for some bumper pool in the rec room. So the president is pushing the Justice Department to investigate his political rivals while he cozies up to murderous strongmen. Somebody should explain to Trump that his behavior is fundamentally antithetical to democracy and the rule of law. Who knows? Maybe he'll say,
now I understand.
This has been a closer look. Our guest is an Academy Award winner and a talented playwright, screenwriter, and director. He's also the mind behind one of my favorite films, In Bruges, his new movie, which is also fantastic. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri will be in theaters this Friday. Please welcome to the show, Martin McDonagh, everybody. So happy to have you here.
Great to be here, Seth.
Absolutely delighted. And I want to get to your new film, but can we talk about In Bruges just a little bit?
We certainly can. I hear you kind of like it a little bit.
I'm a little weird about In Bruges. I talk about In Bruges so much that people have gifted me In Bruges posters. That's right outside my office, so that I see your name every day.
Well, I've never seen that poster.
You've never seen that poster? No, it was a knockoff poster. You didn't get any residuals for it. And someone just bought me a big copper plate that said Bruges on it. So this is a movie
that's
I talk about
heavy.
All the time. Yeah. It is heavy, yeah. Did you, so that movie, I guess, came out in 2007, yes?
Yeah.
And Colin Farrell, Brendan Gleeson, do you look back on that film fondly?
Oh, very much. It was my first feature film, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But Colin and Brendan kind of guided me through it. And we were in Bruges, which is, one of the most beautiful and boring towns in all of Europe.
Well, it is interesting because it's a balance of beauty and not being very big.
Yeah.
You spent a lot of time there because of the film.
I went there maybe a couple of years before I wrote the script and it all just popped into my head instantly, pretty much. And I was kind of really worried that someone else would make a film in Bruges before I got to steal my thunder.
That's really funny because not only did they not, but no one's made one since.
And funny enough, no one ever went to see the movie either, so.
it was interesting because I went to Bruges after the film, my wife and I went to Bruges, and the taxi driver immediately clocked me as an American tourist who came because of the film. So there is a film in Bruges tourism in Bruges.
Oh, really?
Do you feel like the people of Bruges are happy that you made the film? Do they like it?
I've never really been back to check.
But, yeah.
I think the mayor. No, I think the mayor didn't like it either. So maybe.
Oh, really? Yeah. I can't believe they're. Because see, I want to do an In Bruges reunion episode.
I heard this.
Yeah.
I'd like to do this.
You would do it.
If you want your viewing figures to really dip, that would be the perfect.
No, I think that NBC will be really excited about In Bruges Week. but so this film, because I feel like you are such a great writer for actors. And this film, Frances McDormand, who we saw in the clip, absolutely fantastic. Did you write this character with her in mind, or?
Yeah, this is completely for Frances. Like, she's one of the best actors around. And I'd always wanted to work with her for years and years. We met after a play in New York about almost 20 years ago, I think.
Oh, wow.
And then we met again like 7 or 8 years ago, and she said, write a part for me. And,
oh, wow.
And you always obey when Frances tells you to do something. So that's where this film came about.
And she is a very unique character, a very unique look from the clip, sort of the coveralls and the stuff in her hair. Is that a look that you had in mind from the beginning? Do you guys work on that together?
Well, that was pretty much Frances's idea. She plays a character who's kind of going to war with the town and with the police. So she wanted a uniform that she wouldn't have to think about it every day. She wasn't going to coordinate a blouse with a dress. So she's got these kind of mechanics uniform and a bandana. But we wanted a hairstyle that would kind of match. And at one point, we were thinking of getting like a skinhead. And we did a kind of computerized composite of Frances with a skinhead crew cut kind of thing, and it didn't quite... We'd have had even less viewers for this movie as Bruges.
Sub-Bruges. So, you think you would have gone Sub-Bruges.
Yeah, if that's possible. But she did have like a little... If you see the film, she's kind of got a shaven back, but and the rest is swept up. So it's a pretty cool kind of iconic look she's got going.
Also, Sam Rockwell, who you've worked with both on stage and in film, Seven Psychopaths, which is another great film. He, as an actor, especially in this film, he's such a sweet person, and yet he plays both a sweet person and a really awful person. Is that... Again, do you know when you're writing this, this is very few actors could pull this off, and Sam is one of them?
Yeah, I mean, I always kind of tend to write for Sam. There's a voice in my head or a character that I kind of identify him with, which isn't really him because most of those parts have been kind of tough, vicious kind of characters. And as you know, he's the sweetest guy imaginable. But he's one of the greatest actors of his generation, so he can do the darkness and the bullying. But you kind of know that he can peel off the layers and do something beautiful with it, too.
It's great. Your films, this film has some violent moments. I mean, even in the clip, we saw double crotch kicks.
Yeah. And she was only supposed to kick the boy. She just improvised that whole...
Did she really? Oh, I was going to say. Because I think it's very forward-thinking of you. You don't see women get kicked in the crotch enough.
And I know,
you're
right?
Like, this is...
It could catch on.
It could catch on. You
I
know?
Hope it does.
I hope it doesn't either. It was just like, this is Martin McDonagh's fault. All these... ladies getting kicked in the crotch. It's knock on wood, yeah. So, do you have a favorite violent moment in your films? I mean, because you obviously must be drawn to it. And even on stage, you have...
I don't really like violence particularly. There's a funny scene in this one where she goes to the dentist and the dentist gives her a little crap and he doesn't really come out of it unscathed.
No. She turns the tables with the dentist drill.
Yes, yeah. With the drill. Yeah. And it's a little Hitchcockian little moment. If Hitchcock ever drilled a dentist through his thumbnail.
And do you, are you someone who feels a certain way about dentists?
I've never liked them.
Yeah. So was it cathartic for you to write a scene where dentist gets it through the thumb?
It was kind of nice, yeah. And there's a scene with a priest, and the priest kind of gets it too. So they're like my two bete noirs.
So, yeah, priests and dentists, that's always
been... You too, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And you certainly don't want one doing the other job or vice versa. It's just not a lot of good crossovers. So I want to... ask about this as well. You have a show that you had in London, Hangmen. You're bringing it here off-Broadway.
Yeah.
When you bring a show like that, is it usually the same cast?
It depends. I've brought a couple of Irish plays before, and they were all brought the same cast over, but they were like four character plays. Yeah. This one's got like 10 or 11, so we're bringing three of the originals and hiring the rest locally.
It feels to me that you write very specifically in sort of an Irish voice at times and an English voice. When you bring a play like that over, are you surprised sometimes at what works and what doesn't when you bring it to a front of an American audience?
So far, it's been pretty good, apart from in Bruges. Everything else has worked over here. But, I mean, I think with the Irish plays, there's a big love of, Ireland in New York. And we'll see if the same is true for Manchester, England, where this play's set. But sometimes you have to kind of temper the accents of the cast a little bit, so a New York audience can hear it a little bit. But I find sense of humor kind of crosses boundaries like that pretty easy.
You some of your plays, and I mean this with as a high compliment, are pretty up. I've heard you said in an interview your new play is maybe your most up play yet.
Yeah.
Those were your words as well.
I set the bar here, and I've been.
Can you tell us what your new play is about?
This is going out pretty well. Yeah, I mean the synopsis of it isn't too up, but the playing of it is. It's kind of like a life of Hans Christian Andersen.
Uh huh. That's normal.
But in his attic, there's a little woman imprisoned in a box who writes all of his short stories for him.
That's up. Well, I can't wait.
But it's funny.
Yeah, no, I expect nothing less from you. And I really can't tell you, it's such an honor to meet you. I'm such a fan of your work. Thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you, sir.
Martin McDonagh, everyone! 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri will be in theaters this Friday.
Hi, everybody. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm backstage here with Martin McDonagh, who is the director of 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. We discussed this a bit on the phone that the film deals with dark subject matter. Obviously, the lead character's daughter is raped and murdered, and she puts up these billboards, sort of antagonize the police, but get them to start working on the case again.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of humor in it.
Yeah.
And so what was your motivation behind keeping that balance?
Well, I think all of the things I write tend to have some kind of balance between darkness and comedy. But this was very important to be truthful to Frances's character's story and the backstory of her daughter and what's happened. So like every day on set, we would keep that in our minds. We would never be too goofy. And Frances isn't really goofy at all throughout the film. Like the comedy kind of happens around her, but she's always kind of got a laser-like determination to find justice. Mm-hmm. But the film's populated by some great, you know, comedic and just generally brilliant actors like Sam Rockwell and Peter Dinklage and John Hawkes and Woody Harrelson. And they, a little more, can take care of the comedy, you know, because their characters are slightly quirkier. But for me, the balance isn't, you know, you kind of take care of it in the edit a bit more than on set.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Ebbing, Missouri is a fictional place, but you shot it in North Carolina for the most part?
Yeah, okay. Just outside of Asheville.
A lot of your work, your previous work, both theater and film, takes place in the UK or places in Europe. How did you adjust to the dialogue? Because I thought it seemed so realistic and so it really resonated. How did you adjust to that dialogue in Middle America?
Thank you. Well, I've spent a lot of time over the last like 20 years or so just traveling around the country and going to small towns and just listening to people, really. Yeah. Making friends with people and listening. And I've always kind of had an ear for it, I guess. But most of my favorite literature is American-based, I think. So those voices have always been in my head to a degree.
Oh, wow, interesting. What's your favorite type of literature?
I guess like American-wise, I love J.D. Salinger and Flannery O'Connor. He's not actually American. Nabokov isn't American, but he wrote some American books. So,
right.
So that kind of ilk.
Interesting. Okay. We also talked about this on the phone. There's this surprise cameo by a tortoise.
Yeah.
In a really memorable scene.
Yeah. I was planning on a rabbit first because I usually have rabbits in my films. But then I thought, no, you can't do that every time. there was a brilliant improvising tortoise who's got a great character arc throughout the movie in just 3 scenes with no dialogue.
I don't think I saw the 3. I think I only caught 2.
He doesn't do much in the first one, but if you see it again, when Sam sits down to watch TV with his mother, it's not a sandwich in his hand. It's an upside-down tortoise.
Oh, that's the one I missed.
Yeah. And the tortoise is doing good work in there. But yeah, maybe that's why you didn't quite see the arc.
I thought it was a sandwich.
There you go. No, there is a sandwich later, so it's not that.
Okay.
But you'd have spotted
that
sandwich.
Okay, I'm going to go back and look. And your brother, John, is also a director and screenwriter.
Yeah.
And you two lived together for quite some time. You were working. You would work on the bottom floor of the house, and he would work on top of the house.
Yeah, until we were 30, actually. Yeah. And that probably explains a lot of the darkness in our plays.
But when you weren't working, you mentioned that the living arrangement worked because you both like to watch some bad television.
We watch an awful lot of trashy Australian soap operas, which are mostly all set on beaches. So there's a lot of swimwear involved, very little proper writing. So I don't know what attracted us to these things. But yeah, we'd sometimes watch the 1:30 showing in the afternoon and sit down and watch the 5:30 too, because we couldn't get enough of it.
And
not in a very pervy way. It was just something to do while we were reading.
A way to take your mind off of the
darkness.
Task at hand. Yeah. Do you share work with him as you...
No, we even back then, we didn't let each other read each other's stuff. And even now, when he's making a film, I'll only see it at the rough cut stage, you know. So we pop to each other's sets sometimes. But we're so big-headed, each of us, that we don't really care what the other one thinks. But we'll show it to them at the end.
Oh, that's nice. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Kind of nice.
No, it's nice. I think it's nice to have those boundaries.
Yeah, true.
And be aware of them. We're honest with each other.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here. It was great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.